on that fucking phone that enables you to know when your texts are opened and ignored. And Benji, he ignores the fuck out of you. He is more passionate about blowing you off than he is about being inside of you. And this is what you want? You stab at your phone. Your phone. Enough with this phone, Beck. It's gonna do you in. Waste your voice and cripple your fingers. Fuck that phone. I'd like to throw it on the tracks and hold you as we wait for the train to run it down. There's a reason it's cracked, and there's a reason you left it in your basket at the bookshop that day. Deep down, you know you'd be better off without it. Nothing good comes from that phone, don't you see? You do see. Otherwise, you'd treat that phone well. You'd have put it in a case before it cracked. You wouldn't stand here fumbling with it and letting it dictate your life. I really do wish you'd throw it onto the tracks and go offline and turn your head and look over at me and say, "Don't I know you?" And I'd play along, and we'd talk, and our song would be "Engine, Engine, Number 9 on the New York Transit Line. If my train runs off the tracks, can you please stop singing?" You growl. But the dude can't even hear you over the singing and pissing and singing and pissing. And you whip your head around too fast, and damn it, you need to not lean back like that, but you do. It happens so fast. You reach out your arms, but you're wobbling. You drop your phone, and you lunge to grab it, and in the process, you misstep. Ah! And you slip and trip on that damn shoelace, and you fall splat, and somehow you land the wrong way, and you roll off the yellow danger zone and down into the actual danger zone. You scream. It's the fastest, slowest fall I've ever seen, and you're only a voice down on the tracks now. A shriek, and his singing doesn't stop. Engine, engine, number 9. And it's the wrong soundtrack for what I have to do now. Bad back and all. I run across the platform, look down at you. Help! It's okay, I got you. Give me your hand. But you just scream again, and you look like that girl in the well in The Silence of the Lambs, and you don't need to look so freaked out because I'm here, offering my hand, ready to pull you up. You're shivering and staring down the tunnel, and your head's filling with fear when you need to just take my hand. Oh my God, I could die. Don't look that way, just look at me. I'm gonna die. You take a step forward, and you know nothing of railroads. Stay still. Half the shit down there can electrocute you. What? And your teeth chatter and you scream. You're not dying. Take my hand. He's making me crazy, you say, and you block your ears because you don't want to hear "If my train runs off the tracks" anymore. That's singing. That's why I fell. I'm trying to help you, I insist, and your eyes pop. You look down the tunnel and then up, right into my eyes. I hear a train. Nah. You'd feel it. Give me your hand. I'm gonna die, you despair. Take my hand. The homeless dude croons as if we're a nuisance he's gotta out-sing. Pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. And you cover your ears and scream. I'm getting impatient, and an engine will come on these tracks eventually, and why are you making this so hard? You wanna get killed? Because if you stay down here, you will get run over. Take my hand. You look up, and now I see a part of you that's new to me. A part that does want to be killed. And I don't think you've ever been loved the right way. And you don't say anything, and I don't say anything, and we both know that you're testing me. Testing the world. You didn't get off that stage tonight until the last person stopped clapping, and you didn't tie your shoelaces, and you blamed the world when you tripped. Pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. Engine, engine, number 9. I nod. Okay. I reach down with my arms, palms up. Come on, I got you. You want to fight. You are not easily rescued, but I am patient, and when you are ready, you wrap your hands around my shoulders and allow me to save you. I hoist you, loose sneakers and all, onto the yellow danger zone, and then roll you onto the dirty gray, danger-free concrete, and you're shaking, and you hold your knees to your chest as you scoot backward into the part of the green pole that faces inward, the safe place to sit. To wait. You still don't tie your shoelaces, and your teeth chatter more than ever, and I scoot closer to you and I point at your useless, flat, non-athletic sneakers. May I? I ask, and you nod. I pull the laces tight and tie them in double knots the way my cousin taught me 100 years ago. When the train sounds down the way, your teeth stop chattering, and you don't look so scared anymore. I don't have to tell you that I saved your life. I can see in your eyes and your glistening, grimy skin that you know it. We don't get on the train when the doors open. That's a given. Chapter 6. The cab driver was reluctant at first. I guess I would be too. We look crazy from the near death of it all. You're a fucking mess. I'm so clean that it's almost disturbing. Pimp clean to your whore dirty. We're a true pair. But the thing is, you say, going over the recent events for the umpteenth time, your legs folded under, your arms flailing as you speak. The thing is, at the end of the day, I couldn't live if that guy wasn't going to stop singing. I mean, I know I must have seemed crazy. Nuts. But I had a bad night, and at some point, you have to set rules, you know? You have to say, I will not put up with this. I will die before I continue to live in a world where this guy will not stop singing and polluting a shared environment.
You sigh, and I love you for trying to spin this into some sort of strike against complacency and what fun it is to play with you. Still, you were pretty drunk.
Well, I think I would have done the same thing sober.
What if he'd been singing the Roger Miller version? You laugh. And you don't know who Roger Miller is, but most of the people in our generation don't know. And your eyes narrow, and you stroke your chin, and here you go again for the fourth time. Yes, I'm counting.
Okay, did you ever spend a summer working on a ferry?
Nope, I say. You are convinced you know me somehow. You have said you know me from college, from grad school, from a bar in Williamsburg, and now from the ferry.
But I swear I know you. I know you from somewhere.
I shrug, and you examine me, and it feels so good, your eyes hunting me. You just feel close to me because you fell, and I was there.
You were there, weren't you? I'm lucky.
I shouldn't look away, but I do, and I can't think of anything to say. And I wish the cab driver were the kind to babble intermittently.
So what were you up to tonight?
You ask me. Working.
Are you a bartender?
Yeah.
That must be so much fun. Getting people's stories.
It is, I say, careful not to reveal that I know you write stories. It's fun.
Tell me the best story you heard this week.
The best? You nod. And I want to kiss you. I want to take you onto the tracks before engine number 9 grinds to a halt and swallows you whole and fuck the drunk out of you until the New York Transit line swallows us both. It's too hot in here, and it's too cold out there, and it smells like burritos and blowjobs, middle of the night New York. I love you is all I want to say, so I scratch my head. Hard to pick one, you know?
Okay, look,
you say, and you swallow, bite your lip, redden.
I didn't want to freak you out and be like this psycho who remembers every tiny little social situation she gets herself into or whatever, but I was lying. I do know how I know you.
You do?
The bookstore.
And you smile, that Portman smile, and I pretend not to recognize you, and you wave those hands, such small hands.
We talked about Dan Brown.
That's most days.
Paula Fox,
you say, and you nod, proud, and graze my arm with your hand. Ah, I say.
Paula Fox and Spalding Gray.
You clap, and you almost kiss me, but you don't, and you recover and sit back and cross your legs.
You must think I'm a fucking lunatic, right? You must talk to like 50 girls a day.
God, no.
Thanks,
you say. I talk to at least 70 girls a day.
Ha!
And you roll your eyes.
So you don't think I'm, like, stalker crazy?
No, not at all. My middle school health teacher told us that you can hold eye contact for 10 seconds before scaring or seducing someone. I am counting, and I think you can tell.
So true. Which bar do you work at down there? Maybe I'll come by for a drink.
I won't judge you for trying to reduce me to someone who services you, who rings up your books and delivers your picklebacks. I just fill in there. Mostly I'm at the bookstore.
A bar and a bookstore. Cool.
The cab rolls to a stop on West 4th Street. Is this you? I ask. And you like me for being deferential. Actually, you say, and you lean forward, I'm just around the corner. You sit back and look at me, and I smile. Bank Street, not too shabby. You play. I'm an heiress. What kind? Bacon, you sass, and a lot of girls would have gone blank. We are here, at your place. You were looking in your purse for your phone that is on the seat between us, closer to me than you, and the driver shifts. We're in park. Here we go again, with me and the always disappearing phone. Someone raps on the car door. I jolt. The motherfucker actually knocks on the window. Benji. You reach across me and roll down the window. I smell you. Pickles and tits. Benji, oh my god, this is the saint who saved my life. Good job, dude. Fucking Greenpoint, right? Nothing good happens there. He raises his hand for a high five, and I meet his hand, and you are sliding away from me, and everything is wrong. I can't believe this, but I think I lost my phone. Again, he says, and he walks away, and he lights a cigarette, and you sigh. He seems like a jerk, but you have to understand, I lose my phone all the time. What's your number? I blurt, and you look out the window at Benji, and then look back at me. He's not your boyfriend, but you're acting like he's your boyfriend. I'm good, calm. Beck, I say, I need your number or your email or something in case I find your phone. Sorry, you say. I just spaced. I think I'm still kind of freaked out. Do you have a pen? No, I say, and thank God that when I pull a phone out of my pocket, it's mine and not yours. You give me your information. You're mine now. And Benji calls. You coming or what? You sigh. Thank you so much. Every time. I like that. Every time. Instead of any time. It's pointed. Well, I mean it. Our first date ends, and you're going upstairs and fucking the shit out of Benji, but it doesn't matter, Beck. Our phones are together, and you know that I know where you live, and I know that you know where to find me. Chapter 7. My thoughts are firing too fast. You, me, your tights, your phone, Benji. And when I get like this, there's only one place for me to go. I walk to the shop, to the way back, and unlock the basement door. I close it behind me, and stand in the vestibule that looks to Curtis, to anyone, like a storage closet. I fish in my pocket for the true key. The key that unlocks the next door. The final barricade between the shop and the soundproof basement. I lock the door behind me, and by the time I reach the bottom of the stairs, I am smiling because there it is, our beautiful, enormous, beastly enclosure. The cage. Cage really isn't the right word, Beck. For one thing, it's huge, almost as big as the entire fiction section upstairs. It's not a clunky metal trap you'd find in a prison cell or a pet shop. It's more like a chapel than a cage, and I wouldn't be surprised if Frank Lloyd Wright had a hand in the design, what with the stark mahogany beams as smooth as they are heavy. The walls are genius acrylic, unbreakable yet breathable. It's mystical, Beck, you'll see. Half the time when collectors write fat checks for old books, I think they're under the spell of the cage. And it's practical, too. There's a bathroom, a tiny stall with a tiny toilet, because Mr. Mooney would never go upstairs for something as banal as a bowel movement. The books are on high shelves, accessible only by climbing a ladder. Good luck, thieves. There's a small sliding drawer in the front wall, the kind they use at a gas station in a sketchy neighborhood. I unlock the door and go inside. I'm inside and I look up at the books and I smile. Hi, guys. I take off my shoes and lie back on the bench. I fold my hands under my head and tell the books all about you. They listen, Beck. I know it sounds crazy, but they do. I close my eyes. I remember the day we got this cage. I was 15, and I'd been working for Mr. Mooney for a few months. He told me to come in to meet the truck at 8 sharp. I was on time, but the delivery guys from Custom Acrylics didn't show up until 10. The guy behind the wheel beeped and waved for us to come outside. Mr. Mooney told me to observe, as the driver yelled over the roar of the engine.
Is this Mooney Books?
Mr. Mooney looked at me, disgusted by Philistines who can't be bothered to read the sign above the shop. He looked at the driver. Do you have my cage? The driver spat.
I can't get this cage in that shop. Everything's in parts, guy. The beams are 15 feet long and the walls are too friggin' wide to get through that door.
Both doors open, said Mr. Mooney. And we have all the time in the world.
It ain't about time.
He sniffed and he looked at the other dude in the truck and I knew they weren't on our side.
With all due respect, we usually put these babies together in backyards, mansions, big open spaces, you know?
The basement is both big and open, said Mr. Mooney.
You think we're getting this fucking beast into a basement?
Mr. Mooney was stern. Don't swear in front of the boy. The guys had to make at least 24 trips, lugging beams and walls out of the truck, through the shop, and down the stairs. Mr. Mooney said not to feel bad for them. They're working, he told me. Labor is good for people, Joseph. Just watch. I couldn't imagine what the cage would look like when it was done, if it was ever done. The beams were so dark and old-fashioned, and the walls were so transparent and modern. I couldn't imagine them coming together until Mr. Mooney finally called me downstairs. I was in awe. So were the delivery guys.
Biggest one ever, said the sweaty driver. You keeping African greys? I friggin' love those birds. They talk so cool.
Mr. Mooney didn't answer him. Neither did I. He tried again.
Your shelves are wicked high, mister. You sure you don't want us to move them down? Most people want the shelves, like, in the middle.
Mr. Mooney spoke. The boy and I have a lot of work to do. The driver nodded.
You can get a shit ton of birds in here. Pardon my French.
After they left, Mr. Mooney locked the shop and told me the delivery dolts were no better than the wealthy sadists who keep birds in cages.
There's no such thing as a flying cage, Joseph, he said. The only thing crueler than a cage so small that a bird can't fly is a cage so large that a bird thinks it can fly. Only a monster would lock a bird in here and call himself an animal lover.
Our cage was only for books, and Mr. Mooney wasn't kidding. We did have a lot of work to do. Workmen installed sealant in the walls that rendered the entire basement soundproof. More workmen came and built and expanded the back wall of the shop so that the door to the basement opened first into a vestibule that contained the real door to the basement. We were building a top-secret, soundproof clubhouse in the earth, and I woke up so excited every day. I assisted Mr. Mooney as he wrapped dust jackets in custom-fit acrylic cases, gently, Joseph, before placing the jacketed books into acrylic boxes with air holes, gently, Joseph. Then he put that box into a slightly larger metal box, gently, Joseph, with a label and a lock. When we had 10 books or so, he would climb a ladder in the cage, and I would pass him the books, one at a time, gently, Joseph, and he would set them on those wicked-high shelves. I asked him why he had to go through so much trouble for books.
Books can't fly away, I said. They're not birds.
The next day, he brought me a set of Russian nesting dolls. Open, he said. Gently, Joseph. I popped one doll in half and got another doll, and popped that doll in half and got another doll, and so on until the final doll that could not be popped in half, the only whole doll in the bunch. Everything valuable must be hidden, he said. Or else. And now you pop into my head, and you're more beautiful than a doll, and you'll love it in here, Beck. You'll see it as a refuge for sacred books, the authors you love. You'll be in awe of me, the key master, and I'll show you my remote control that operates the air conditioners and humidifiers. You'll want to hold it, and I'll let you. And I'll explain that if I wanted to, I could jack up the heat and cook these books, and they'd turn to mold and dust and be gone forever. If there's any girl on earth who would appreciate my power, it's lovely, unpublished you in your little yellow stockings with your dream of writing something good enough to get you inside this cage. You drop your panties to get in here, to live in here forever. I drop my own drawers and come so hard that I go deaf. Fuck, you are good. I try to stand. I am dizzy. Gently, Joseph. It's almost time to open, and I catch my breath, and I go upstairs. There are only two of us who work here now that Mr. Mooney is retired. There's Curtis, a high school kid, kind of like I was back in the day. He does stupid stuff just like I did. Heck, when I was 16 years old, Mr. Mooney gave me a key, and of course, one night I forgot to close the cage.
You failed, Joseph, said Mooney when he was younger, but still old, the kind of guy who was never young, not really. You failed me, and you failed the books.
I'm sorry, I said, but we never shut cabinets or doors in my house.
That's because your father is a pig, Joseph, he said. Are you a pig?
I said no.
A few days later, I snuck into the cage and took out a new, old Franny and Zoe, a signed first edition. I decided to like it more than Catcher in the Rye, just to be unique. And I loved it, Beck. What a book. Sometimes I flipped back to the beginning just to rub my finger on Salinger's signature. You had to pay $1,250 to do what I did, but I didn't pay. And neither did the woman who stole it from the desk at the register. I would recognize her anywhere. She had reddish hair and a paisley scarf and was 30, maybe 35. She paid cash. I told Mr. Mooney I'd work extra to make up for it, and I promised I would find her. I cut school and skulked the streets until my toes were bleeding. But it's hard to find a woman when you don't know her name or where she lives. Mr. Mooney ordered me to go into the cage and close my eyes. I was scared. When I heard him lock the door, I knew I was locked inside. I didn't have a ladder, so I couldn't reach any of the books. You can't walk into the Louvre and kiss the Mona Lisa. I had no phone, no sunlight, no darkness. All I had was my brain and the buzz of the AC unit and the daily slice of pizza, cold because steam is no good for old books, and coffee, lukewarm in a cup from the Greek diner, both of which Mr. Mooney slipped to me through the drawer. The days and nights got lost. Mr. Mooney cared enough about me to teach me a lesson. I learned. He let me out of the cage on September 14th, 2001, 3 days after September 11th. The whole world was different then, and Mr. Mooney said my father had never called. He probably thought I was dead.
You are free, Joseph, he said. Be wise.
I didn't spend as much time at home after that. It wasn't hard to slowly disappear. My mom left when I was in second grade, so I grew up knowing that it was possible to leave people, especially my dad. I don't feel sorry for myself, Beck. Lots of people have shitty parents and roaches in the cabinets and stale, raw Pop-Tarts for dinner and a TV that barely works and a dad who doesn't care when his son doesn't come home during a national disaster. The thing is, I'm lucky. I had the bookstore. It doesn't take a fucking village to raise a child. Mr. Mooney was the boss now, the dad I wanted to do right by. I kept hunting for the Franny and Zoe thief, and right after 9/11, I wasn't alone. Everyone was like me, searching the streets. People wanted to find their families. I wanted to find the thief. There were flyers for missing people all over the city. I thought about learning to draw and plastering the city with drawings of the thief. I could pretend she was my mother. I didn't go through with it, and sometimes I think the thief died in one of those towers. Karma. But most of the time, I think she's probably out there alive, reading. I am in the L through R fiction stacks when the doorbell chimes, and I am ready. You told your girlfriends you would come by around this time. I know this because I have your phone. And you are not the kind of girl who locks her phone with the 4-digit password. I have been reading your emails. I've taken pictures of the passwords you keep in your password folder. This way, when you change your password, if you change your password, I'll know the possibilities. You are not the kind of girl who comes up with new passwords. You have 3 in rotation. Akbeck 1027, 1027 lowercase me, capital me, 1027 Beck $ ale. It gets better. You don't want to tell your mother that you lost another phone. You went and got a new phone with a new number and a new plan. I know all this because your old phone is still active. So I read the mass email you sent to your friends announcing your new phone number because I can read all your email.
Hannah was mortified.
WTF. Tell your mother you lost your phone and get that shit shut down. Identity theft. Perverts. Beck, seriously. Tell your mom you fucked up. She'll get over it. People lose phones. Get the phone shut off. It's not that dramatic.
You wrote back.
Phone is probably in gutter, so yes, it's really not dramatic. If someone does have it, I'm a poor MFA candidate with debt. Who's stealing that identity? And if someone thinks I'm pretty enough to put my selfies all over the internet, well, then I'll feel pretty. Smiley face. Just kidding. But seriously, it's all good. I wanted a new phone anyway. I love my new number.
Hannah would not relent. You get a new phone when you tell them you lost your old phone. Your mother will know you lost your phone because your new phone number. Also, $$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$$
told my mom I changed numbers because I wanted a New York one. She doesn't even know how to text, let alone read the bill. It's fine. And money? Whatever. One more little bill isn't going to kill me at this point, you know?
Hannah didn't reply. And I love your mom.
Thanks.
And I love you. You little hypocrite.
Your old, but still working,
phone is an encyclopedia of your life, and it will be open to me as long as your mother pays the bill. Score one for the good guy. Oh, Beck, I love reading your email, learning your life. I am careful. I always mark new messages unread so that you don't get alarmed. My good fortune doesn't stop there. You prefer email. You don't like texting. So this means that I'm not missing out on all that much communication. You wrote an essay for some blog in which you stated that emails last forever. You can search for any word at any time and see everything you ever said to anyone about that one word. Texts go away. I love you for wanting a record. I love your records for being so accessible. And I'm so full of you, your calendar of caloric intake and hookups and menstrual moments, your self-portraits you don't publish, your recipes and exercises. You will know me soon, too. I promise. Starting today. You're here.
Hang on!
I call out as if I don't know it's you up there, and I'm so full of shit. I trot up the stairs and into the stacks, and you're here, in a plaid jumper and knee socks, and you dressed up for me. I know you did, and you're holding a pink, reusable bag.
Engine number 9, I say, and you laugh. And I am so good when I have time to prepare. What's up?
I go in for the hug, and you let me hug you, and we fit well together. My arms take you. I could squeeze you to death and to life, and I pull away first because I know how you girls can be about this stuff. Your basic instincts ruined by magazines and TV.
I brought you something, you coo.
You didn't, you respond.
I did.
You didn't have to.
Actually, I didn't die, you laugh, so I kinda did.
We're walking up to the front, and I know why we're walking up there. You want me. You want me here. You know that if we stay in these stacks, I'm gonna press you against the F through K placard and give you a present. And I'm behind the counter, and I sit as I planned, with my hands intertwined behind my head as I lean back and put my feet up, and my navy t-shirt lifts just enough so you can see my midsection. You need something to dream about. And I smile. Show me what you got, kid. You lay it on the counter, and I lower my legs and move forward, and I'm hunching over the counter. I could touch you, I'm so close, and I know you like my cologne, because you and Hannah lust after a bartender who wears this cologne, which is why I bought it, and I open my present from you. It's the Da Vinci Code, in Italian. And you clap, and you laugh. And I love your enthusiasm, and this is something that comes more naturally to you than writing, giving. You are a giver.
Open it up, you say.
But I don't speak Italian.
The whole book's not in Italian.
I flip through, and you are wrong, and you grab the book and drop it on the counter.
I know for a fact that the first page is in English. Open.
I open.
Ah. Yeah, you say. Read up.
There you are, in black ink. You wrote to me. Engine number 9, on the New York Transit Line. If some drunk girl falls on the tracks, pick her up, pick her up, pick her up. I read it out loud. I know you get off on your writing, and you clap at the end, and there it is, in writing. You are literally asking me to pick you up, and you nod, and your name is there, so it's not freaky when I say it. Thank you, Guinevere. It's Beck. I lift up the book. But it's also Guinevere. You concede, you nod. You're welcome. I took off my name tag in the cage. You are pretending you don't remember my name, and I help you out. Joe Goldberg. You are welcome, Joe Goldberg, you say, and you sigh, and on you go. But that's kind of fucked, right? Because I came here to thank you, and now I'm saying you're welcome? Tell you what, I say, and this is it, just how I practiced. Now that we're both alive, and nobody's singing, and you got me this sweet-ass present, which is great because of all the books we have in this place, Italian Dan Brown is not one of them. I noticed. You sing, and you blink, and smile, and you're rocking a little. I breathe. This is it. The next step. Let's get a drink sometime. Sure, you say, and you cross your arms, and you're not looking at me, or saying a specific time, or date, or place, and now there are elements of our dynamic coming slowly into view, like a photograph in a dark room. You didn't write your number in the book, and you got me the joke part of our thing, Dan Brown, instead of the shared serious part of our thing, Paula Fox, and I think you have a hickey. A small one, but still. You bought Paula Fox for Benji. You bought Dan Brown for me. The thing is, you say, I still can't find my phone, and I don't have a new one yet, so I'm not making a lot of plans, you know? Yeah. I pretend I have to check something on the computer, and I think of the way you emailed your friends about me, the way you talked more about the fact that I rescued you than the fact that you're obsessed with me, so obsessed that you had to pretend you didn't remember me. You didn't tell Hannah and Lynn about the way you think about me when you mount your green pillow, about how nervous and intimidated you were with me. You were so nervous and distracted by me that you lost your phone, Beck, remember? Instead, you email your friends about Benji, and I have to speak or I'll blow it. So, you never found your phone? No, I mean, I think I left it in the subway station. You had it in the cab. Oh, right, I did. But I mean, who remembers the name of the cab company, right? Premier Taxi of Lower Manhattan. Nobody ever remembers the name of the cab company, I agree. You ask me for a pen, and I give you a pen, and you grab one of our bookmarks, and flip it over and write down your email address that I already know. Tell you what, you say as you scribble. I'm really busy with school and stuff, but why don't you email me and we'll make a plan? I hope you know those bookmarks are for paying customers only. You laugh, and you are awkward without a phone to dive into, and you look around, waiting to be excused. You really do have a daddy complex, Beck. Not for nothing, but these books aren't going to sell themselves, so why don't you skedaddle and let me, you know, get back to work? You smile, relieved. And you almost curtsy as you back away. Thanks again. Every time, I say. And I plan that. And you smile, no teeth. And you don't say goodbye, and I don't say, have a nice day, because we are beyond pleasantries, and you gave me your email address, and now I have to choose which draft to send to you. I knew you'd come in, and I knew you'd give me your email, so last night I wrote different versions of my first email to you. I was up all night writing, Beck, just like you. I was in my cage, Beck, just like you. I put your bookmark with your email in the Italian Dan Brown. It fits perfectly. Chapter 8. I hope that most people at this point in time realize that Prince is one of the great poets of our time. I didn't say songwriter, I said poet. Prince is the closest thing we have to E.E. Cummings, and people are so stupid because they don't come in here and buy books of Prince poems. It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. That is one of the greatest first lines of a poem in all time, for a number of reasons. primarily because of the reversal of hours and days. A non-poetic person would cite days and hours. A poet is different. A poet transforms the world with such small hands. You haven't written back to me yet. You have forwarded my email to Hannah and Lynn. You have giggled over photo booth pictures of the three of you, Hannah, Lynn, us, and exchanged dozens of idiotic emails about nothing. You have found the time to read and respond to your classmates' short stories and beg the bosses at Word in Brooklyn to let you read, but you haven't written back to the guy who saved your life. You are still in pursuit of Benji, and it has not been 7 hours and 15 days, but we are getting there, Beck. It's not funny anymore. You wrote to Hannah Lynn, "How come I have to be a stereotypical chick that meets a nice guy and is like, thanks, but no thanks? I don't read Cosmo or do cleanses or post selfies, which means I don't fit the profile for lame girl who hates nice guys. I mean, Benji is married to his business, and this guy is the total opposite. Works at a business, you know? Also, rooftop at the Wythe on Friday?" Hannah wrote back first, "Beck, is this the guy you met at KGB? Wythe, maybe." And this tells me that you meet too many guys. You have this hunger for strangers. That's why you read Craigslist casual encounters. No, you don't have casual encounters, thank Christ, but at the same time, you treat life like a giant fucking casual encounter, wasting time with Benji, with random guys from places like KGB. Lynn wrote back, "They got shrinks on campus that can answer that question, girl." Smiley face. "Also, KGB guy was super cute. Also, Wythe, yes, unless maybe Upper East Side for a change? Just a thought." These girls don't know about our Italian Dan Brown and the extent of your crush because you don't tell them. And finally, in the middle of the night, after 5 hours and 8 days, you write back to me, "How about happy hour on Thursday?" I wait 3 hours and 1 day to write back. That works. Where? You didn't earn my humor this time. You don't write back right away. 4 minutes, 3 hours, and 2 days pass before this bullshit stinks up my inbox. "Sorry, oh my God, one of those weeks. Whatever you do, do not go to grad school. Anyway, how about next week?" Like Prince, I have a poetic nature, and I know how to shift my perspective. Driving you into my arms isn't working out, clearly. You are scattered, and you flirt, and you crack phones, and you don't delete anything, and you use your period to get extensions at school, and a lot of your emails have more creative vitality than your stories, and you're talking to like 9 dudes on 9 different sites. You flirt with everything. Do you realize how much crap you have in your shopping basket at anthropology.com? Christ, Beck, you need to learn some decision-making skills. In the meantime, I see that you are sick. Sick like your father was. You're hooked on Benji. And I can't get you off Benji until I know about Benji. Which takes all of about 35 seconds. Benjamin Benji Baird Keys III is a friggin' joke. He's been to rehab, which is a travesty. You can tell by his smug face that he's not capable of genuine addiction. He owns an organic club soda company that symbolizes everything bad about right now. His business is called Home Soda, a superior alternative to commonplace club soda because, while a club is exclusive, a home is the most exclusive place in the world. You can get into a club if you pay a cover. The same cannot be said of a home. Beck, you can't tell me you buy into this. Not really. Benji's little startup is a runaway underground Whole Foods-style success, and his pastel-laden website includes a diatribe on Monsanto, as if this kid's parents don't profit directly from Monsanto, as if this kid wasn't fucking raised on Monsanto. Literally, his dad worked for fucking Nestle when Benji was a kid, and yet Benji rants. A photo essay, otherwise known as a fucking slideshow, reveals that Benji came up with Home Soda while camping with friends on Nantucket. Camping is a bullshit term.
Nantucket is not New Hampshire, and Benji was staying at a friend's waterfront summer home. I blow up the photo and see the untagged girl from your Facebook profile. Aha. So you know Benji through that miserable odd girl who does have a legitimate smile reserved for wealthy friends in staged propaganda photos. But did you go camping with them? Nope. You probably weren't invited. Your friend probably fed you some bullshit excuse about there not being enough room on the beach. You are the townie and Benji is the tourist who literally enters you and uses you as a vacation from the wear and tear of the artisanal club soda business only to dump you before Labor Day. He is the daddy you try desperately to please, the daddy who leaves no matter what you do. Your emotional livelihood is a demented seasonal economy where Labor Day is every other fucking day. He rents you out the same way he rents loft space in Sobro, South Bronx, to those of us who don't need to make up bullshit pet names for neighborhoods where we're not wanted. And he cheats on you, Beck. A lot. Compulsively. He is in intense pursuit of a performance artist who fucks with his head the way he fucks with yours. It has been 6 minutes and 3 hours and 1 day when you email me. This is random, but I'm in Greenpoint. Are you maybe bartending right now? I respond. I'm not, but I could meet you at Lulu's. You respond. It is on, baby! Sorry for all caps. I'm just excited. I wait 12 seconds, 9 minutes, and no hours before writing back. Ha ha! On my way. 5? You don't write back. But I have to take 2 trains to get there, and the Hannah and Her Sisters soundtrack is playing in my head, all the songs at once, so loud that I can't listen to the music on my phone or the music on your phone, and all I can think about is our first kiss, which will likely take place in 18 seconds, 19 minutes, and 3 hours, when we are both drunk in a cab on Bank Street, and I get it now. Why dudes jerk off on trains sometimes. But I don't. I have you in my future. The train can't go fast enough, and engine number 9, and look how much we share already, and we haven't even fucked, and I got you a present, too. I'm bringing you the Western Coast, and it's inscribed. Engine number 9, on the New York Transit Line. If you go in a nursing home, this here book will be your tome. It's not perfect, but it's close, and I had to buy you something, reward you for stepping up, and the train is here, and I hope that Prince eventually got to be where I am, pounding up the 16 steps and 2 blocks and 1 avenue toward the rest of his life. But I'm only halfway up the subway stop stairs when your phone beeps. There is a lot of information to process, and I have to sit down, and I do. Things have changed. Quickly. Too quickly. Nearly 2 weeks after your mass email announcing your new phone number, Benji has emailed you back. Hi. And you wrote back, come over. And he wrote back, smiley face. And then you emailed me. Ack, I had to go to a school thing. Reschedule for next week? Sorry. And then Benji wrote to you. Give me an hour. Work thing came up. And you wrote back, smiley face. You're smiling because you want life to be like it was before your father messed up on Nantucket, without secrets, without danger. You write about how safe it is there, how claustrophobia and comfort go hand in hand. Your family never locked the doors to the house or the cars, and they left the car keys in the ignition, but come March, you'd give anything to see a stranger. You tweeted a few weeks ago, the island of hashtag Manhattan is like the island of hashtag Nantucket. Groceries are expensive, drinks are expensive, and in winter, everyone goes nuts. That's cute, Beck, but the island of Manhattan is nothing like your precious Nantucket. Let me tell you what I did last Tuesday. On the island of Manhattan, you have to lock your shit up, or some streetwise guy might just stop by a freaking club soda factory for a tour on a Tuesday when he knows the boss isn't around, special thanks to Benji's Twitter feed, and excuse himself to use the bathroom, and bypass the bathroom for Benji's office, which is unlocked, and bypass the rest of the club soda tour for a private tour of Benji's computer, which is also unlocked, and learn that Benji keeps a calendar with links to @LotsaMonica's performance schedule. She's on today,
live doodling at a converted fire station in Astoria, bite me. As a verified fan of hers on all social media platforms, oh, the things I do for you, Beck. I am granted access to the live coverage, and though I don't see Benji the man, the place is too crowded, I see bottles of home soda in all the filtered pictures. He's there. A comment from some chick with bangs and pink glasses proves it.
Benji rocks for bringing club soda, hashtag organic for life, hashtag home soda, hashtag drink free or die.
So there it is. Your precious Benji doesn't show up at your reading, but he treks all the way to Astoria in the middle of the day because he thinks Monica is superior, because she's tall and blonde and he mistakes her doodles for art. I have to calm down. You don't know about this. You're not a fan of Monica's because you're not an imbecile. But you need to know, and I can't get out of that bloated factory fast enough. I need to save you. I am the kind of guy who prepares for emergencies like this, so I already have an email account called HerzogNathaniel@gmail.com. You don't do your research, so you don't know that Nathan Herzog is the food critic at Vulture's new Eats section who sucks the tit of pretentious beasts like Benji and his home soda. I read the guy's stuff. I'm not impressed. But Benji kisses his ass, tweeting his reviews in a flagrant effort to get his own puff piece on the site. And over at the exhilarating news blog on homesoda.com, fans of Benji's pussy water grumble incessantly about why home soda has yet to be featured on Vulture. Until now. Obviously, I use my new email account to impersonate food fuckwad Nathan Herzog. And soon, Benji will receive an email from Nathan Herzog, who just sipped the most fantastic club soda of his life and realizes he is late to the party but remains desperate to meet Benji. He writes, "Is there any way you could meet now? There's a bookstore on the Lower East Side, Mooney Rare and Used, and it's a great place to start. There's a cafe downstairs. Nobody knows about it. Sincerely, N." It takes Benji only nanoseconds to reply. "Absolutely, Nathan. I'm flattered, and I'm en route." I don't respond. What kind of an asshole says en route? I'm on the subway thinking about you when I realize that I fucked up. Something is missing. The Western Coast, with my signed inscription. I left it on the sidewalk when I took a minute to recover after realizing you blew me off and Mr. Mooney was right. I will never be fully capable of running the bookstore. I am not a multitasking businessman at heart. I am a poet, which is why I know that I am 4 stops, 1 transfer, 3 blocks, 2 avenues, and 1 flight of stairs away from stopping at my apartment to pick up some treats for Benji. I text Curtis. "No need to come in today. I got it covered." He writes back, "Sweet." Chapter 9. I round the corner and see Benji yanking on the door to the shop, and I caught him too, even better. I smile broad. I own this fuck. "There he is," I call. "The home soda man." "Mr. Herzog, it is a true honor," he coos. "That fucking kiss-ass in a Brooks Brothers blazer, and for what?" "Sorry I'm late," I say, and I fake a fumble for the keys. Food critics who are part owners of cafe book hybrid places are, by nature, a clumsy folk. But it's worth the wait, I promise. I unlock the door, and we're in. And Benji's too nervous to notice that I locked the door behind me. "This place is a gem," he marvels. "They serve coffee here?" "Now and then," I say, and I could work for New York Magazine's bullshit website. I watch Mad Men and know about Jay-Z and overpriced ramen. "For now, though, would water do?" "Excellent, Nathan." Excellent, Nathan. So while Benji prattles nervously about how much he loves books and bookstores and people who read books, I am pouring a baggie of crushed Xanax into a glass of water. He'll gulp. He's nervous. He takes the water. He thanks me. He can't even say thank you without sounding like a phony. I let him go on and say I've just got to tend to something behind the counter, and he is all apologies, and "That's perfect, Nathan, and I cleared my calendar for this," and I'm moving papers around and listening to the Xanax overtake him. Did I put enough in? He's woozy, and he wants to sit down. He almost wobbles toward the counter.
Do you mind? Is there somewhere I could sit a minute? Punching him is gratuitous. But then he did use the word excellent a dozen times in 20 fucking minutes. He's out cold and on the ground, and I walk into the main floor and lift his feet. Here he goes, down the stairs. He doesn't wake up while I drag him into the cage, and I lock him in there and smile. Excellent. His Brooks Brothers blazer provides a wealth of goods. There's his drug purse, packets of heroin or coke or Ritalin or whatever the kids are doing these days, and a plastic key card. I leave that. There's his wallet. I take that. And then there's the grand prize that is his phone. I don't have to tell you that I take that. Benji is as fearless as you, Beck, and within seconds, I have access to his Twitter, his email, and the Home Soda blog on the website. Naturally, his phone is full of pictures of the Monica performance artist person. She is nauseating, splayed, always posing. I pick a sexy one and tweet it from Benji's account. Two words accompany the photograph. Hashtag beautiful lovely. Hashtag yes. You are meant to interpret this as Benji's way of calling you hashtag inadequate, hashtag no. And you do. Oh, Beck, it hurts to see you cry, feel so rejected. Don't you know how much I'd like to go hug you and prop you against that green pillow and fill you with love and mass-produced club soda? I want all that, but I can't intervene. You need your space to detach from this asshole, and I wait for your sadness to turn into anger. And then it does, and you write like a snake. You slither. I am not your fucking plaything, Benji. I am not a no-hearted, phony, piece-of-shit performance artist cum dumpster. I am a human being, a real human being, just like the song. And you do not blow me off. Do you hear me? This is not how my life goes. Treat me like you treat your soda. Or you know what? Better yet, fuck your soda. Give that a shot. Stick it right in there, into that glass bottle, and fuck your soda, because that's what you love. You don't love me. You don't love anyone. Your emails are true and beautiful, but there's a problem. They all get stored in drafts. You don't have it in you to send them. You're still holding on to this towny fantasy that this shaggy-haired camping tourist will throw away his ideals for you. You want that. There's not a lot I can do. So I stand by. I read your emails. Kana is right.
Honestly, Beck, it would be nice if Benji loved you, but he doesn't. So it's not surprising when he bails on you and cheats on you and pulls that weird daddy shit, you know? This will sound weird, but I am happy for you. Let this end already.
Lynn chimes in. I think there are no good guys in New York. It's not like I'm in some rush to get married. I love it at the UN, and I would rather go work in Prague than get married, but honestly, I don't think there are good men here. They're all Benjis.
Hannah writes back. Get off eHarmony, Lynn. Seriously.
I am optimistic. Until you have a separate private email exchange with this peach person. You're different with her. You.
I sound like such a girl, but I haven't heard from Benji. He kind of bailed on me. He's probably just busy, but what if...
Peach. What if you got so busy writing something awesome that you forgot about him? It's like in yoga when you put all your energy into one sacred place. You.
You.
You are so right. Thank you, wise one.
But it doesn't matter what your friends think. You're still drafting emails to him, and now you want to know where he is and when you're going to see him. You want him. Still, you need my help, and I forge an entry in Benji's home soda blog. Spontaneous trek to the ACK. New inspiration, new flavors with the help of a lovely companion. He is the kind of asshole who would refer to Nantucket by its airport code, ACK. And of course he didn't invite you. He didn't tell you he was going. He just left. He's no good. And he used the word lovely. And you're supposed to think he's with Monica and write him off once and for all. Still, you send the link to Peach and you are sad. Not mad. She writes back. Sweetie, he's an entrepreneur. And he's probably referring to Rascal, his family's lab. Don't jump to conclusions. We are at an impasse. None of this has worked. You forgive this fucker who tweets a filtered photo of the come fuck me soda cunt.
There were no cases of gratis home soda at your reading, Beck. But you still want him, and I still have to fix this. I send you an email from Benji. Long story, be well, kid. You open the email seconds after I send it. You don't forward it to your friends, and you don't draft another violent fuck you email. Now you are still, and I am not surprised when my phone alerts me that I have a new email an hour later. It's you. Thursday instead? I did it. Finally. I have only one word for you. Yes. When the little pansy wakes up, I don't know how much time has passed, but he's yawning like it's been a century. He doesn't seem to get it at first, and he makes awkward small talk about the cage. Is this mahogany? And then he talks about parrots. Finally, it dawns on him that there are bars separating us. He reaches for the door, and for the second time today, I watch this prick yank a door handle. You don't need to do that, I say. I try to keep him calm. I am kind. Let me out, he snaps. Now! Benji, I say, you need to settle down. He looks at me. He is puzzled. Candace's brother was also puzzled. The assholes are always puzzled when the order of the universe is restored, when they are held accountable for their cowardly, pretentious, loveless ways. Chapter 10. It's Thursday morning, and our date tonight is my reward for the past 3 days. Babysitting Benji is no joke, Beck. I don't even know how many times I've locked and unlocked and locked the basement doors as I've come up and down. Curtis knows he isn't allowed in the basement, and he doesn't have a key. My hand is cramped from gripping the key like it's my lifeline, and it is. And I'm tired, Beck. It took me a solid hour to pry up the false-bottom floorboard where I keep my machete. I had to take a train all the way to New Haven to use his ATM without raising any flags. I'm not saying it's not worth it, and I did come up with a good plan. I decided to use Benji's phone to construct a narrative. I know. It's a fucking brilliant plan. Because you follow him on Twitter, you will now bear witness to his descent into drugs and idiocy. It all started in New Haven, where I got $2,000 out of his account and tweeted a photo of the bullshit Yale Bulldog mascot. The original hashtag Bulldog is back. Hashtag what up, New Haven. Hashtag me and Molly. So now everyone, you, will think Benji's gone back to his alma mater for a bender. If there's one thing I've learned about Ivy League people, Beck, it's that you all really like going back to school for reunions. This is a good plan, and I can't let his fancy boy belly aching get to me. It's like you know I'm at my wit's end, and you text me. Hey, you. Up early. No idea why. So what are we doing tonight? Smiley face. Benji barks. Is that Beck? Joe, if that's what you want, she's all yours. We've been through this. About an hour after he came to, the fucker recognized me from the cab. So now he thinks he's figured me out. He thinks I'm obsessed with you. He thinks I trapped him in here because of you. The truth is so much more complicated, and self-satisfied chirpers like him don't know that it's always wiser to be quiet in lockup. He laid his cards out, and he talks about you like you're his. But you're not a beat-up BMW. You're not his to give away. I bark, do your test. Joe, he says. Which is dumb, because every time he says my name, I'm reminded of the fact that he knows my name, an obvious complication going forward. I compose myself, and I write to you. Morning, sleepyhead. Hope you had sweet dreams. See you at 8:30 on the steps at Union Square. When it gets dark, we'll go somewhere else. I hit send, and I can't wait to see you. And I pick up the list of Benji's 5 favorite books, because we've got work to do. Gravity's Rainbow, by Thomas Pynchon. He's a pretentious fuck and a liar. Underworld, by Don DeLillo. He's a snob. On the Road, by Jack Kerouac. He's a spoiled passport-carrying fuck stunted in 8th grade. Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, by David Foster Wallace. Enough already! The Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane. He's got Mayflowers in his blood. Benji has already failed tests on Gravity's Rainbow, duh, and Underworld. He keeps saying he would have made a different list of books if he knew there was a test coming. That's how privileged people think. Lie unless you know that you can't get away with lying. You're nothing like him. And you write again. Smiley face. There's no fucking way I'm responding to a smiley face. And I can't anyway, because Princess Benji wants a soy latte and a New York Times and some Kiehl's and his fucking Avion and his Tom's toothpaste. I tell him to make do with what I gave him. Coffee from the Greek diner, a New York Post, a small tub of Vaseline, and a scoop of baking soda from the centuries-old box in our employee restroom. You write again. Where are we gonna go after it gets dark? I can't be mad at you, because you're obviously just hot for me. You wouldn't be mirroring my words if you weren't excited, and I write back to you.